Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It was a great privilege to sit down with the legendary actor Gary Oldman and talk about his portrayal of Winston Churchill in his latest film, Darkest Hour.
In the war room, there's the chair that he used to sit in the war cabinet. On the left-hand arm of the chair, there are these divots and grooves from his fingernails. And on the right-hand arm are the scratches from his ring. The behaviour is a piece of history that you can touch and see.
Check out the rest of the interview on my podcast, Dan Snow's History Hit, and make sure you go and see Darkest Hour when it's released to all good cinemas on January the 12th. It's an awesome film.
It's the fighting. It's the fighting. Clock. It's the fighting. It's the fighting. Clock.
Oh, that was really interesting, mate. Yeah.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Fighting Cock, The Extra Inch. This time, number six is going to be called Stats, I think. Because I'm joined by two of the sharpest statistical minds in the Twitter sphere, and also a newlywed Bardi. Bardi, my sidekick and best friend, welcome back to The Extra Inch.
Thanks for having me back, Windy. I missed the last one. I listened to it with tears in my eyes.
With Coxie as well. How good was he?
He was really good. I really wanted to meet him, and I couldn't. So I felt really jealous. I was hoping to be like a power cut or something would go wrong so you could get him back.
How's married life treating you so far?
It's been 2 weeks. It's been okay. I'm a man with responsibilities now. I've got things to look after and things to take care of. It's good.
And you're looking very tanned.
Yeah, well, Colombia's quite hot. It's near the equator, so it's sunny on occasion.
What were the temperatures like?
It hit like 38 degrees at some points, and then in other parts of the country, it was just pure humidity. It was like trying to walk through a steam room constantly.
Nice. Well, you're looking very well, mate, and it's good to have you back. Also joined by our tactics guy, Nathan.
How's it going, mate?
Good, thank you. How are you, Nath?
Yeah, not bad. Spoilers, you're about to mention it's been a year since our first episode.
And yes.
In that time, I've lost nearly 4.5 stone. So that was a nice little
reminder of where I'm at. Very nice. Impressive.
That's,
well done to
that's
you.
That's the zone I'm in.
And I'm delighted to welcome Duncan Alexander from Opta, who you may know on Twitter as Oily Sailor. Duncan, welcome.
Hello.
Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, you've got a book out at the moment, which we're going to spend some time talking about later and give you an opportunity to plug that and tell us all about it. But we're going to start off by talking about XG, or expected goals, because this season analytics have gone mainstream. Match of the Day is using XG, which is quite surprising. But you told me an interesting thing earlier, that you pitched that to them.
Yeah, well, it's obviously a model we developed 4 or 5 years ago, which is slowly caught on in the professional clubs and, you know, the blogosphere. We made a decision early this year to try and, you know, push it out to the media, the more traditional media. And Match Today obviously is, you know, possibly the most traditional in the sense that it's the, you know, it's the one bit of football that my mum watches. So I'm not sure she's quite grasped XG yet, but, you know, at least she can see it. So,
have you had much feedback so far?
There was quite a lot on the first Match of the Day of the season. I had a look on Twitter and, yeah, there were some people who were pleased, but there were some people who were displeased or angry, shall we say. But, I mean, I think it's just one of those things where, you know, anything new tends to lose some of the crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, football fans are so divided into the types of fan that they are. We did speak about XG briefly in the last Extra Inch, number five, with Michael Cox. And Nathan, I thought, gave a really good sort of summary of how it works. But Duncan, when you were on the Totally Football show recently, you said that you felt that XG tells the hidden story behind the game, which I really liked. I like that way of describing it. How would you kind of explain what XG is to someone who's never heard of the term before?
Yeah, I think possibly the term XG turns a few people off, particularly the word expected. I think a lot of people tend to think that it is it's kind of a predictive thing that's looking to the future, which it isn't. It's basically a look at chance quality. You know, we've got a database of over, you know, 300,000-400,000 shots. So each one of those shots has taken place in a specific point on the pitch with a specific scenario, you know, a counter attack or a corner. And we can also look at things like how the shot was taken. Was it with a foot? Was it with a head? So you put all these factors together and you basically work out an average for each type of chance in a particular location. And then when a player, an individual player or a team has a shot, you can then rate that against the average. So that's all it does. So as you'd expect, some players are better than the average and some players aren't. I mean, and what, you know, the thing about telling the hidden story, I think, you know, every fan knows they've come out of games and said, oh, you know, our striker, you know, could have had a hatful today, or, you know, our player scored in the last four games, but he's playing terribly. You know, sometimes reality doesn't tell the actual truth of what's going on, and this kind of hopefully gets underneath that a little bit.
Interesting. We had a question from Seamus Hart because there are multiple sort of models of XG that different people have developed over a number of years, and Seamus asked which is the best XG model and why, and should people with no understanding of XG models be using XG if they don't know what it actually means, which I thought was an interesting follow-up question also. Do you have a theory on which is the best model?
Well, I mean, they're all pretty similar. You know, they all, the differences between them are pretty minute.
Yeah.
Some might weigh, you know, certain elements a little bit higher than others. Obviously, I would obviously say that ours is the best, but I think it probably is because we've got the biggest database. You know, you know, a lot of the other ones are based on smaller subsets of data that people glean through various ways. And ours, you know, we can actually, you know, we can weight different competitions slightly differently. So if you take a league in, I don't know, Scandinavia, you might weight that slightly lower than La Liga or the Premier League because, you know, it's pretty obvious that scoring a goal there is easier to do than in a top league. So we have the ability to do that. And we're always looking to kind of tweak it, and you know that even this season or the end of the season, I think, you know, there might be a good tweak that we're going to do as well. So.
Interesting.
I think one of the criticisms of XG has been the fact that it's quite a rational kind of statistic to apply to a game in a sport which is completely irrational, and you have a situation like at the end of a game where your team has lost, maybe for example Spurs against Manchester United, where we had a higher XG rating, I think, and it's just like you now have to explain to somebody who's already furious that they've lost and say, but we expected to score more goals, and then their instant reaction is, but we didn't. And it kind of like there was the famous Craig Burley against Marcotti after Bayern Munich got knocked out to Atletico, I think it's 2016, where it was just like ideal in results kind of quotes come from. And I think that's where a lot of the criticism for XG comes from, that you're applying something rational to something which makes people totally irrational.
And that was massively highlighted when Michael Cayley, who's a big Spurs fan based in New York, who's also a kind of football analytics guy, he posted his XG findings from the Real Madrid and Spurs tie, which had Real Madrid at 2.1 and Spurs at 0.8. And the reaction to that was pretty harsh, to say the least. People were not impressed, I guess, by the fact that he was posting that after one of the most historic results in Spurs' recent history. I mean, in Michael's defence, he posts the XG after every game, like pretty much right after the game. So there was nothing unusual about the fact that he'd done that. But I guess it's just, like you say, this dispassionate take on football, which got people's backs up.
Yeah, and it's a kind of like the Brendan Rodgers take on it, that we won possession, so we should have won the game. And it does get people's backs up a little bit.
I think the Spurs reaction was that that Michael was taking away from the result, and I don't think I can understand why people would have that reaction and the sort of the entitlement that comes with the term expected goals. But I think you can watch that game and say, well, yeah, Real Madrid had all the ball and they made a lot of chances, but we snatched it, and to overachieve expected goals is an achievement in itself. Just because Real Madrid created higher quality chances doesn't mean there isn't a lot of pride and a lot of joy to take from that game.
I think this is quite a key point, is how you present it, isn't it? Because as a neutral watching that game, it was a brilliant game. You know, two teams playing, both playing well, but in slightly different ways. But, you know, Madrid clearly had more chances, but Tottenham handled them really well at the same time. One data point isn't going to tell the whole story of a match. There's obviously going to be a lot of nuance in there. And I think that is, again, key to how you present stuff. So you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to be a zealot and sort of say this one number is going to revolutionise football, because it's not, you know.
What was the rationale for match of a day using XG rather than XGD, which is the difference between expected goals scored and conceded?
I think that's probably even more of a you know, complicated idea.
Too much for people to take in.
Yeah, I mean, even XG, it's going to take a few years before it becomes, you know, if you go back 10, 15 years, assists were seen as kind of a mysterious work of the devil that would never catch on, but they really are kind of just part and parcel of the game now. You know, everyone knows what an assist is. And it does take a while for these things to filter through, but there will be a difficult period where it is, you know, new, in inverted commas, and you just have to work through that, and hopefully, you know, people will get it sooner rather than later.
So with that in mind, which do you think is the next underlying stat that's going to hit the mainstream as such?
Yeah, so we've got expected assists, which is also out, which is, you know, as you might expect, a similar model in some respects to expected goals. It basically looks at every completed pass and applies the chance of it becoming an assist. So obviously a pass between two central defenders is pretty much got negligible chance of being an assist, but if you're playing a lot of passes, you know, into good positions, you can apply expected assists. But again, that's possibly even more complicated to get your head around than expected goals. But one that I think really will work in terms of kind of the public grasping it quite quickly is a thing we've got called sequences. So we can, you know, we've always collected individual events, but now we're able to link them together. So, you know, there's always been players who might have been key to a chain of events, but won't necessarily have a goal or an assist. So, if you, in a Spurs context, you know, Christian Eriksen last season was first or second in terms of being involved in sequences that led to a shot. I think he was top, actually. So he might not have played the final pass, but he was always in that chain of events. Similarly, Alexis Sanchez at Arsenal's, you know, especially him, he didn't have a season that sort of leapt off the, you know, in people's imagination, but he was always involved in everything they did. And it's kind of again under, you know, finding that hidden kind of contributor, really.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I guess Luka Modric would be another fine example of someone who when you watch him, you might not think he's doing much that affects the game, but we know that actually he's doing a whole bunch of stuff that affects the game, but it just might not be that visible.
Yeah, and in the stats, we're not, you know, like I said, we're not zealots, and also we take on board what people say. You know, the historical criticisms of stats, things like, you know, OX might have a pass completion of 95%, but they're all sideways. You know, we're always striving to kind of put more context around events and hopefully, you know, tell a better story.
So what do you, when people like Graeme Souness, who's come out this week, and he was speaking in the paper about Pascal Gross, who's the Brighton attacking midfielder they signed from Germany in the Bundesliga. And Souness has made this point that Gross was shown to have created 95 chances last season and only had 4 assists. And Souness seems particularly angry about this point and how someone can be using it to promote this player. What do you think that does for people like you in your industry? Do you feel like it sets you back when someone as high profile as Graeme Souness is saying something like that?
Not really. I think, you know, I touch on it in the book, actually, because there's a whole chapter about Liverpool going 27 years without a title. And, you know, when Souness came in to Liverpool in the 90s, he's a bit, you know, wrongly maligned in a sense. He actually was more progressive then. He'd come from, you know, recently played in Italy and stuff. So, you know, but I guess as people get older, they can't become a little bit more entrenched in their views. I mean, that point was very... The point he made out of possession was sort of fair enough, but the one about the chances and assists, you know, you could put Messi in a Sunday league team. He might make a lot of chances, but no one takes them. It doesn't mean he's not a good player. You could argue that Brighton's scouting was good there because they found a player that, you know, was very creative, but possibly went under the radar because he wasn't, you know, assisting a lot of goals.
The point he made about possession is essentially the one you made a minute ago about how a player can have 95% pass completion, but then he says those passes can all just be 5 yards to the left and 5 yards to the right. Well, 5 yards is a statistic, and that's a piece of information that you can apply to pass completion. You can say this player had this pass completion with an average length of this or an average zone of this. So his argument against statistics is based on statistics.
Yeah.
So he shot himself in the foot, essentially.
I think so.
And what he was saying was ultimately that the stat is ridiculous, but actually you could use that stat to prove that that stat's ridiculous. So what's he arguing about?
What he's finding ridiculous is the conscious misuse of statistics to create narratives, to create stories that are or aren't there. And I think we all feel that way, but that sort of giving statistics a bad name, and that's the overriding issue.
I think there's something that Duncan touched on in his book. It's about the, I think you actually said the nerdy approach to analysing. All of a sudden, it's clashing with the kind of dressing room culture and the kind of macho kind of image of football, and it's just like getting stuck in and all this kind of stuff. And it will take time for people to understand it. And to be honest with you, there are Sam Allardyce, somebody who's renowned as being like a long ball merchant stuff. He was one of the first to actually start using data to his advantage. So that it is happening, but I guess it's going to take even longer for people on the terraces and stuff to kind of accept that this is where the game is going. This is the revolution of the game now.
I really want to talk more about the dressing room culture and how they've taken to statistics, but can we just first touch upon the data collection element? Because we were talking before we started recording, and I was fascinated by the method that's used by Opta to get this information in the first place.
Yeah, in my head I just imagine like an airplane hangar full of people with like headphones on and a clicker, and you know, like a bouncer in a club, as someone goes in clicks, so each time pass is completed, one hand for incomplete, one hand for complete, and that's in my head, that's what was going on.
So how does it work, Duncan?
Yeah, I wouldn't hire any of them as bouncers. we've had the same analysis system since about 2006. We've obviously, you know, tweaked it in the interim, but it's custom-built software. We essentially get it's done two people, one person for the home team, one person for the away team, and a third person who kind of QAs the data as it comes through. They get a screen where they get video footage of the match, but then they have to transpose that obviously 3D image to 2D, a 2D pitch. So obviously the camera will track the ball roughly in the centre when it films a football match, but they then have to say, you know, this pass came from the edge of the D to the left flank. And it's a, you know, you not only have to have amazing knowledge of the team and players, particularly if you're doing a far-flung league, but you have to have that kind of lateral thinking where you are not panicking and you're constantly just collecting the data. And it is, you know, it takes about 6 months for the guys to be trained and let loose. And it is, you know, they collect around 2,000 bits of data a match. So it's full on. I mean, they're the only people that absolutely love a very serious injury because they can, just
have a break.
Yeah, have a little rest.
So what about things like ground distance covered by individual players?
We don't collect that, but we get access to it for certain competitions. You know, for instance, the Premier League, we're the official data supplier, so we can access that information. I think there's going to be some big advances in statistics in terms of combining data sets. That's very much kind of the way things are going. So if you can combine, you know, our event data with tracking data, you can suddenly look at, you know, players who are making them overlapping runs. You can look at players who are particularly good at shooting under pressure, things like that. So it kind of opens up a whole sort of, you know, new set of data points.
With the tracking data, would it be literally like a heart monitor on a player would be able to track the number of sprints they've made or the amount of distance?
Well,
the
tracking world now is there's two approaches. There's optical, which is obviously cameras in a ground, which relies on a lot of technology and, you know, access to grounds and stuff, but at least you're not reliant on the player having to remember to wear wearable tech. Obviously most clubs will use wearables in training to track stuff. A couple of years it is now since FIFA approved that for in-game. I know Swansea and the Premier League do it. Wickham, who I support, did it on the first day of the season a couple of years back against Plymouth, and Plymouth refused to play the match. And I'm not sure it was because they're from Devon and a bit scared of technology, but they, the Wickham secretary had to go in and print off the letter from the Football League saying it was okay to wear them. But I mean, I think it's interesting actually, League One, League Two teams have been doing that more because they obviously have less data generally, so they're kind of more keen on collecting it in game in that sense.
But that's so fascinating. So Plymouth may have been scared that Wickham were going to have this competitive advantage where at half time they'd be able to read off this data and say, right, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this wrong.
Possibly, although I think it was more that they were worried. They were claiming it would be dangerous jumping at corners and stuff, but I mean, players wear it in rugby and stuff, it can't be that bad. But
that's bizarre. But that brings us on nicely to something else I wanted to speak about, which is the the use of data at clubs. And there's been enormous growth in analytics departments, and we saw it at Spurs when we brought in Paul Mitchell from Southampton with his famed black box. Don't know how long that lasted, probably about as long as Paul Mitchell. But we know that Spurs were using a lot of data for recruitment, but also for match analysis. They were using it post-training. They were using the black box to show videos and had their own editing suite for that kind of thing. Do you have any insight into how and how much clubs are using data to analyse matches and player performance?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I can't really go into specific examples at clubs because they're understandably keen on keeping that to themselves. But, yeah, you know, we work with pretty much every major club in Europe and around the world, and, you know, we're not the only player in that space either, so, you know, there's plenty of others as well. And I wouldn't think there's a single club in the top division of any major competition that isn't using data in some way. What's interesting, or not interesting, as the case may be, but it often only ever gets brought out when there's either a very strange success, like Leicester City win the league, or where the manager gets sacked and is kind of looking for a bit of a excuse. I remember when Brendan Rodgers left Liverpool, there was a few articles in various places sort of bemoaning their transfer committee. Although if you actually look at the players the committee signed, like Firmino, etc., been pretty good compared to the ones that were, you know, done more traditionally. So, you know, as you say, it's done for recruitment, it's done for player performance, it's, look, you know, opposition. We hold an event every February called the OptPro Forum. OptPro is our kind of professional club wing, where people from the industry, be they kind of amateurs or from clubs, will come and present. And the first year there was a really interesting one by a guy who works at Manchester City, and he actually showed how they take Opta data, they pull out passing patterns, and then he showed a video of Pellegrini, as it was at the time, on the training pitch physically moving Yaya Toure and Silva around. It was actually for a game against Tottenham, and then he showed the game. I think it was, they win 5-0 or 5-1 at White Hart Lane, and three or four of the goals basically came from them intercepting in those exact passing channels. So it was a really interesting kind of example of how a club will take raw data, do something with it, apply that to the training pitch, and then move on to a match scenario.
As Spurs fans, I think we're the only ones who didn't celebrate Leicester's kind of miraculous title.
Yeah.
How far would you say that there was it a combination of data and luck and the right manager and the right players at the right time, or was their success all down to them using the data? And
it definitely wasn't all down to data. I mean, as many people have pointed out, you know, football is such a low-scoring game that luck will play a disproportionately high part in football compared to other sports. So, you know, you could repeat that season many times, and you can run it on various different metrics, and sometimes Spurs will win, sometimes Arsenal will win, Leicester less than those two, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I think what the two interesting things with Leicester when they won the league were, A, obviously their recruitment was very good, and that was very data-led. So, you know, get not only buying Kante, but buying him from a team that played in a very similar fashion to them. So it wasn't like he had to come in. You know, we've all seen players come into the Premier League who are good players, but really struggle to adapt because they're basically playing in a completely different way to how they used to. Whereas Kante was able to basically just carry on, and he has, obviously, at Chelsea as well. But and the other thing was really interesting was the way Leicester completely changed their approach halfway through the season. So the first half of the season was all about Vardy and Mahrez and, you know, counter-attacking. But, you know, Premier League teams are pretty adept at adapting. And halfway through the season, Leicester have kind of been figured out. And then they basically became this amazing defensive team. And they won all those games. I think they won, was it 5 in a row, 1-0, which is pretty unprecedented. And that basically was what won them the title in the end. You know, Spurs for sort of semi-valiant attempt at hunting them down, but they didn't really, after the Arsenal game, when Arsenal fan team were doing the selfies in the dressing room, they didn't really have another slip, and that was the kind of most impressive thing, really. They got figured out, and then they worked out another way of doing it.
Do you have a feel at all for sort of the size of analytics departments at clubs and whether they've grown over the last few years? Because we hear so little about it in the mainstream media, and as a fan, you don't really have an idea of how much data is being used. I mean, we would like to hope that when it comes to recruitment especially, that we'd be using a lot of underlying data to identify players. But then we go and sign someone like Moussa Sissoko for £30 million. So you begin to doubt whether it's actually happening. Another example would be Clinton and Gee. I mean, it seemed like a completely bizarre signing, and in hindsight, it's, you know, maybe slightly less so because he's gone on to do better, but the fact remains that he didn't seem to be a good fit in any way for the team, so you sort of start to question what the club's looking at.
Yeah, football's quite strange in the sense that, you know, it has a transfer window where you can do, you can spend months researching and years researching players and making sure they fit, and then, you know, you lose the first two games of the season and everyone panics and it's like, get some, we need some bodies in and all that stuff. So, you know, the susceptibility to panic is still quite big. But I don't, you know, all the top Premier League teams will have very extensive departments, and not, and I think they're diversifying more and more. So I think people are kind of realise that you're not ever going to kind of find the kind of holy grail stat like you did in baseball, for instance. And it's going to be more sort of, you know, marginal gains ish kind of approach where, you know, little kind of advances here and there will make a difference, be that in recruitment or tactics or whatever.
I've sort of been poking my nose around jobs in the industry a little bit, and what I often find is from, including Premier League clubs, but Football League clubs advertise for a performance analysis, and that includes all variation of tasks, all the way from coding, which you mentioned earlier, which is watching the match and recording all the things that happen, through to presenting the data and the tactical analysis and all the stuff of that. And that to me indicates fairly small staff committed to that side of things. So I suspect that there's still quite a way to go within clubs.
Yeah, I think generally, I think you can probably pick out a couple. I mean, Manchester City are probably the most advanced, I'd say, in that respect, in terms of size of department. And but yeah, it will take a bit of time, obviously. But I think it is. I think probably the biggest disconnect is kind of converting it into a language that managers and or chairman will accept. Mm. And that is, it's all very well having a bunch of really clever guys that can analyse football and come up with good stuff, but if you're not presenting it in the right way, it's never going to reach that, you know. And I know people in the industry who've worked for clubs who, you know, they just can't get through to the manager, and that's where it kind of falls apart a bit.
I think this is one of the beautiful things I like about Pochettino, is I know there's a lot of science and everything else behind it, but when you still look at him and the way he brings through younger players like Kane, Winks and stuff, there's still kind of like a little bit of romanticism about it, that someone like Kane, who, I don't know whether he ticked the boxes as a youngster, then all of a sudden explodes onto the scene like that. That's what I quite like about Pochettino's Tottenham.
He seems to be kind of a mix between the old and the new in his style of management. He's very much a gut feel kind of guy, and I don't just mean his gut feel, but he'll take the gut feel of the players and he'll listen to them, and he'll really take that into consideration when he makes a decision about their performance or their participation in a match. So if the player doesn't feel right for whatever reason, that's a big deal to him.
You know, that's what makes you think Sissoko wasn't probably anything to do with him either.
Well, you think that?
No, I don't think so.
It was just forced upon him. He said, I want a player that matches these criteria, and they said, here you go, have Musa.
Yeah.
Lucky guy. So let's talk a bit about your book, Duncan. Mm. So you've published this book, Outside the Box. Where did the idea come from? Is this something you kind of always had in mind to do?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've worked in the kind of data industry for 10 or 12 years now. So I've seen, you know, data go from a super niche kind of thing through to, you know, fairly mainstream, but still not actually mainstream. And I don't come from a data background. I sort of did history, and, you know, my love of football stems from reading Shoot and Match when I was a kid. So I kind of wanted to do a history of football, particularly sort of history of the Premier League, given it was 25 years of the Premier League, with numbers, but not kind of numbery. So it's kind of a narrative history of the Premier League and other things like the World Cup and various other things, using numbers, but still, you know, you don't have to be into data to read it. It should be appealing to everyone.
So the idea is that it's accessible to anyone, regardless of whether they've got a particular interest in numbers.
Yeah, it's more kind of using numbers to debunk stuff or highlight things that people might have forgotten, or, you know, that sort of thing.
I finished the book on the plane on the way back from my wedding, and I thought you were quite brave in writing a whole chapter, almost like trolling Liverpool, about you listed every single year that they hadn't won the league and why they hadn't won the league. I was quite brave of you to do that.
So some Liverpool fans have enjoyed that, some haven't. But I think it's possibly my favourite bit of the book, I think. it's almost extraordinary Liverpool gone 27 years up in the league. If you'd have said to a Liverpool fan in 1990, you know, before you win the league again, Leeds will, they'd have been confused. Blackburn, they'd have been very confused. You said Leicester, they'd have, you know, just walked off, I think. But, it, you know, they've come close a lot of times. I think the interesting thing is, if you go through it each season as I did, every time they've come close that summer, the media, who love Liverpool, obviously, have been like, next year, it's their bat, it's their year. And they've always just fallen away massively. They've never been able to sustain 2 or 3 years.
So. I didn't realise how many times they had come quite close. There was more than just the Benitez. There was the years when Manchester United had finished third and they'd come second, and they seemed like genuine title champions.
Yeah, Phil Thompson almost took them to the title, which is a strange concept. That, you know, they won, like, you know, a lot of games in the season. It was the year Arsenal 0-1-0-2. Arsenal won the last 13. So, and then yeah, Roy Evans nearly did it, and obviously the Benitez one and the Rodgers one. But yeah, a bit like Spurs with Leicester, you could replay a lot of those seasons, and Liverpool would have won the league. But the fact is, they haven't. So,
was that Liverpool pattern something that you always had in your head when you were writing the book, or was it something that came to you through research?
It was more that I mean, that's the beauty of working with numbers, really, is that you might be... I mean, a lot of the stuff we put on Up to Joe isn't necessarily stuff we've thought of. It's stuff we've found while we're looking for something else.
Yeah.
So someone will ask you, you know, the last time, is Harry Kane the first player to do blah, blah, blah? And as you're researching that, you find something else. And, you know, and before social media, those sort of things would just disappear into the ether, but now there's a hopefully good channel to push it out on.
You must get thousands of requests a week from people tweeting Up to Joe.
Yeah, some of them are better than others.
You get some very niche requests, do you?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we always do, on April Fool's Day, we always put some April Fool's ones out, and those ones will get quoted like months later, and you're like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that, because everyone thinks it's true. But...
As a Tottenham fan, immediately my eyes are always drawn to any stat involving Tottenham, and I didn't realise that King actually did play. He managed to play one full season, 2004-05. He played all 38 Premier League games.
Yeah,
and that just blew my mind. I thought we'd never were able to squeeze a whole season out of him.
It was just before it all hit, wasn't it?
And then there was another one which I said I was going to call you out, where you actually used the term Spursy, where Tottenham are the team that's lost the. Has most often led at half time and then gone on to lose the game. I saw that stat and I was just like,
I remember that we had that stat came up a couple of years ago, and we're the opposite as well.
We've
the most times that we've been losing, we've come over. So we're an absolute chaotic roller coaster of a club.
But it's one of my pet hates is that, and it's not restricted to Tottenham. Every fans of every club do it. Whenever their team lets a lead slip, they're like, well, that's typical Huddersfield, or you know. It happens to everyone. It's like, you know.
But Spurs more than the rest.
And the other one is Harry Kane is the striker with the most own goals in Premier League history.
Already, he's just I mean, if you think of the way he plays, he'll be back defending more than, say, Aguero would or someone. But it is, you know, it's a good job he's scoring so many at the other end of the pitch.
Off the top of my head, I can remember two. There was the one against Swansea and Sunderland. Yeah. I can't remember the other one.
I think he's often at the near post on corners a lot. So, and that's
it's easy to glance
horrible,
one.
Yeah, to just sort of shin it or whatever.
Didn't he take a crazy swipe at one that just flew into the top of the
that
net?
Was Swansea.
Well? That was Swansea.
But I do remember Bale scoring one against Liverpool where he kicked it into
his own face. Yes. I'll never forget that.
He scored at the other end as well for that one, I think.
Yes. Yeah, Liverpool almost won the league under Rodgers, and Martin Skrtel scored 4 in one season. Good going.
That's impressive in one year. I think Richard Dunn scored the most own goals. He was famous for it. It felt like he's scored 4 a season for about 10 years.
Yeah, I think he's the only one in double figures, which is, again, impressive.
Carragher
obviously scored more Premier League goals for Spurs than he did for Liverpool.
That's right, yeah. Brilliant stat.
Because we've had this big vacuum in our right-hand side of our team when Walker left and has been replaced by Trippier, I've become a little bit obsessed with Trippier doing take-ons. And in one of the articles you talked about a guy whose birthday is today, Maradona, who managed to do 90 dribbles in the 86 World Cup. And I was just like, Kieran Trippier hasn't done one in like 2 seasons, and Maradona did like 90 in 10 games.
I think you'll find that Trippier has done one, and Nathan's got a thread on Twitter about his take-ons, which is genius.
I've done a sort of an ironic cut up with sort of over the top dubstep to his 2-3 take on so far, and they're all backwards, and they're all followed by just like a sideways sort of backwards pass at least.
So his take on is running back towards his own goal.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Desperately seeking safety. bless him. So in terms of going back to your book, Duncan, what did you find, what was the toughest part of writing a book? Was it just getting started? I imagine that just taking on an enormous task like that must be really kind of scary.
Yeah, pressing Control N on a Word document is always a tough moment. But I think this one, because obviously the year before I did the Opta Joe football yearbook, that one, I think the second one was harder in the sense it covered the history. I mean, it goes back to the 19th century in places, so it was a lot more to kind of condense. And but I think it was more enjoyable because you're just covering a lot more stuff. I don't think there was any particular bits that were harder than others. It was just, it's a big old task, you know.
Were you doing this just in your spare time?
No, I did it as part of work as well.
So it's part of a project at work, as well as...
But I mean, it was a mixture, so... Yeah. But it is, I mean, anyone who's written a book will, you know, agree that it is, you have to get into a certain mindset. And some days you can bang out 2,000 words, and some days, you know, you've struggled with 200, so...
Really?
Yeah.
And was it a case that you were kind of researching as you went along, or were you, did you do a lot of research before you started writing?
It depends on the bit. So there's a chapter about why World Cups aren't exciting anymore. And kind of we, up to a few years ago, went back and analysed every World Cup from 1966 onwards. Not out of some, you know, mad England thing, but just because that was the first World Cup where every game was televised. So obviously we need TV footage to collect the data. So we have a complete record of every World Cup from 66. So you can compare Cruyff and Pelé and Maradona and stuff, which is really cool. But you can, in the chapter in the book, it basically goes through the different eras of World Cups. And like you said, Maradona was exceptional, you know, but he played in a very... Not only is the dribbles high, but he was fouled a ridiculously high number of times, over like 90 times across two World Cups, which is, in, you know, and I sort of wonder whether he obviously was one of the greatest players ever, but it's almost like he was suited to that sort of football. You know, he was so sort of squat and strong that if, you know, Peter Reid's flying in at your knees, he could handle it. Messi probably couldn't, but, you know... Yeah, that's why I don't think you can compare players that across eras that much. Because
Maradona actually said the English treated him quite fairly. So I think maybe because in 82 he had the Italians kicking him, and then he had the Koreans early in 86 who properly butchered him as well.
England did still foul him 9 times in the quarter final in 86, so I suppose that was relatively fair.
Yeah, targeted to some extent.
He got us back as well.
England fouling Argentina is something that's always happened, I think. In your book as well, Alan Ball made 35 fouls against Argentina in 66.
It's so funny because we always think of them as the dirty team.
As the dirty team.
Yeah, I think it was a total England fouls. I think it's the most fouls in any World Cup game without a booking. So, obviously, that game's famous for Alf Ramsey saying that they were animals, but who were the real animals?
Hashtag. I'm a big lover of the World Cup, and I will continue to... see the merit in World Cups. In fact, it's only 4 years and it's not quite as diluted as the Champions League is. I admit the Champions League is probably a higher quality, but for me, I think the fact that the World Cup is so spaced apart, and the fact that you have got countries who can't go and spend 50 million buy players and stuff, they're kind of limited with the talent.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And they've got, I think that for me, that will always give it an edge over a Champions League.
Yeah, I do make the point actually that I think it's very much geographically based. So in England, England have been so bad in World Cups for such a long time now that, you know, people are disillusioned, whereas you go to a country that's just, you go to Costa Rica, I'm sure they're absolutely loving the World Cup at the moment because the last one they had their best ever. Do you know what I mean? So it is very much dependent on how you've done.
I was in Colombia and they qualified after getting a 1-1 draw with Peru, and the whole country was alive. For them, it's an amazing thing, and it's totally different to the feeling that we have here, where people just can't be bothered with it. And it is totally dependent on the country. Some places love it, others don't. And me, I will always love the World Cup.
Don't miss the extraordinary new film, Darkest Hour.
Let them see your true qualities.
My poor judgment.
Your sense of humour.
Ho, ho, ho.
Gary Oldman is the winner of a Golden Globe for Best Actor.
You ask what is our aim? Victory!
Now nominated for 9 BAFTAs, including Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Film.
We shall never surrender!
Darkest Hour, in cinemas now.
So, what's next for you, Duncan? Do you have another book lined up? Is that something you'd be interested in doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got a few ideas for the next one. I want to kind of continue to marry kind of history and numbers and that sort of approach. So I think, you know, I only really touched the surface with this one, even with the Premier League, but I think there's so much more out there. So I've got a few ideas that hopefully come to fruition pretty soon.
It seems to be pretty positively received so far, and I enjoyed James Richardson reading out a quote on the Totally Football Show, which must have been a slightly bizarre thing for you, having like a broadcasting legend like that reading out a review of a book that you've written. I don't know, that must have made you feel pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Where can people get your book?
It should be in all your favourite and unfavourite bookshops, or, you know, the websites that everyone knows.
Is there a particular source where you get a better profit?
No, not particularly. No. So, yeah,
just buy anyway.
Get it where you can.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're going to move on slightly away from statistics and onto tactics. And Nathan mentioned earlier that it's basically a year since our first Extra Inch podcast. And in that first one, we were speaking about Pochettino's tactical principles and ideas from his beginnings as a Bielsa disciple to what he did at Southampton and then his early Spurs 4-2-3-1. But this year's been quite different, and I think we've always seen progression through Pochettino. Last year he brought in the 3-4-3, which worked superbly. That was something that Bardi had long spoken of. You wanted a back three for years.
Love a back three.
And this year we've seen him change again with a back three but with two up front, or a diamond in midfield, which again seems to be slightly harking back to some of Bielsa's principles, although we don't have our wing backs tucking in, whereas Bielsa would always have done that. But what do you feel's next for Pochettino, Nath? What's the kind of next logical step for him? And what have you made of these recent changes?
I feel like he may well be sort of nearing the completion of his playbook. I think that with the addition of the sort of the more counter-attack style that we've seen, I think we're going to talk about this later, but the counter-attack that we've seen against Dortmund, against Liverpool, against Real Madrid, and the 3-5-2, I don't know. All he can do is find a way to make what we have got more sustainable. I was moving away from this idea before, but after Dembele came on against United, and I know that United scored, I do feel that we improved. So there's still that slight air of we need Dembele. We're still good without him. I don't know what else Pochettino can do. I think we're nearing the end of his cycle of progress.
What do you see as the optimal use of Dembele now in terms of what formation he fits best into?
I think he, and I don't know if he still does. I don't know what his fitness is like or what the capacity for it is. I think he enables the 4-3-3, which allows sort of three out and out attackers on the pitch and allows the wing backs to really go forward. I think the best use of Dembele is saving him for the optimum games, even if he's fit. Just have him hang around because he's so prone to injury, and Winks is such a capable backup that put him in ice and lock him away.
Do you think he could do a job as the deepest lying player, like the role that Winks took on away at Real Madrid?
I think you want his ability to take the ball past players rather than stay deep and distribute the ball. Mm. So you're always going to prefer Winks to stay deep, or Wanyama or Dier or whoever. So I think he's going to remain positionally where he is.
A shuttler off to the side of a more natural holding player.
I get the feeling from how Pochettino's setting the team up now is that this this is the furthest away I think it's been from his team. He's constantly having to try and piece a team together because we don't have Dembele, we don't have Wanyama, we haven't had Rose, and we're constantly, he's constantly having to put players in positions where they're not quite comfortable. And I think this is the most impressed I've been with him. I know there's been issues with recent games we've lost, but he doesn't have the team he needs. He needed an alternative to Kane and we got Llorente, and he's struggling, but he's still managing to eke out the results. And I think that is big kudos to him for being able to do that, because I think this is probably the weakest squad we've had at the moment.
Weakest squad?
I think so. The fact that he's had to kind of squeeze Sissoko into this kind of central midfield player because he's not, he can't, he's technically not good enough to play in a free behind the front man, and to move him into centre midfield, I think it's the weakest because of the injuries we've got.
Yeah,
and that's why, that's what he's fighting against. And our recruitment was great, and Davinson Sanchez is an amazing player, but he didn't get the players he needed to really put his own stamp on, and he's having to kind of fight fires constantly now.
Do you have a feel for Pochettino's style, Duncan? What kind of impresses you about him as a tactician as such?
I think it's just his adaptability. I mean, you know, you get managers who are very good, but they're very, you know, you know what Mourinho's going to do. He does it very well, but it is a sort of, you know, one playbook really. But Pochettino, like Guardiola, Guardiola's a bit more kind of, you know, set, but in a very kind of advanced. So, I mean, I tweeted when City had scored a lot of goals the other week that they'd already equaled Stuart Pearce's City in the whole season. And you had a lot of people come back, obviously saying, yeah, yeah, but they've had a half a billion, all that stuff. But it's not that, because you could give Stuart Pearce or Tim Sherwood half a billion pounds to spend. It's people, you give it to someone like Guardiola or Pochettino, and it's, you know, that's where they show their kind of ability, I think.
Well, Man City did give half a billion kind of to Mark Hughes, and he signed Roque Santa Cruz and players like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
Santa Cruz, the only one season did he ever get into double figures for goals, and it was the season just before Man City signed him for a lot of money.
I have brought this up numerous times, but I feel like the one area in which he's lacking still is substitutions. And I really enjoyed the article by Alistair Tweedale for the Telegraph at the end of October, where he's talking about whether managers impact games with their substitutions. And he pointed out that at that point in the season, Spurs subs had only scored one goal, and that was Moutinho Sissoko scoring in the 91st minute against Huddersfield when we were already 3-0 up. And also that our subs have failed to provide a single assist in Premier League or Champions League games. And the comparison was primarily with United, who'd at that point got 10 goals or assists by subs, now 11, as we know only too well. And also the point that the average time of our first sub was in the 69th minute, which is the second latest after Southampton. And our second substitution tends to come in the 81st minute and third in the 89th, and both are by distance the latest in the entire league. So he's making subs late, he's making changes late, they're not having an impact. Does that say more about the fact that he just simply trusts his first 11 more, or is it he doesn't really see what's happening in games until it's too late?
I think part of it is maybe that he doesn't have the bench he needs to be able to affect games, whereas Mourinho can throw on Anthony Martial, Jesse Lingard, these kind of players. We've got Sissoko, and Son is probably a great impact sub, but we need him to start. So we don't have the depth. And we saw in the League Cup game, we bring on Georgian Kudu, who doesn't look like a footballer at the moment. And that is unfortunately the problem we have at our club. We don't have alternatives. And the one great hope that we all have as Spurs fans is Marcus Edwards is this amazing player who can be this impact sub that we need.
I think he's still quite limited by his fitness regime, and he goes into games knowing this player needs to be off before this time and this player needs to have 20 minutes so that he can build the fitness for the weekend. So I think that dictates a lot of what he does. I do feel that this season we've maybe started to push towards more tactical substitutions going on. I'm now going to struggle to think of an example at all, but that's just the feeling I have.
Yeah, no, I've kind of got that idea as well, that he's tried to change things up a little bit more. And I think once Dembele is fully fit and can be trusted to play a significant stint, then with him and Winks both in the squad, you've got options there for what you can do in midfield, which helps a little bit.
Winks was our impact sub. He would come on to close games off, but now he's having to start as well.
Yeah.
And I guess if Lamella ever returns to fitness, he will have another option there.
And Lamella's a brilliant impact sub. We've seen him numerous times come off the bench and have an impact, not necessarily in terms of goals or assists, but in terms of what he brings to the team in pressing in those last 15 minutes, keeping the ball at the right end of the pitch and stopping teams kind of countering on us. So you're right that injuries have had a massive impact, I think, on his use of subs.
Llorente had quite a good substitution against West Ham, coming on, starting a bunch of fights to run the clock down. I thought that was pretty good use of substitutions.
go on and run about a bit and do plenty of shithousing.
Yeah, basically. Like it. Expert shithousing, Llorente.
We've had some questions from listeners, and we'll start off with I know Alan Gilzine on Twitter, who says, how and why has Pochettino changed our performances in Europe this season? I think you were sort of touching on that earlier, Nathan.
Yeah, I mean, essentially he is doing something that he's shown very little sign of doing before, which is to play on the break. We sort of looked at it a little bit before. We played it against City once, we played it against Arsenal once, but that struck me as sort of something that was thrown together in order to get through the game. This seems like this is his plan B. This is what this looks like. This is our alternative approach, as something that we've seen this season. Yeah, it's as much about the quality of the teams that we've been playing. There's a really strong top six in the Premier League. We drew Real Madrid and Dortmund in the Champions League. We're playing at Wembley, which does seem to favour counter-attack teams. But I think it's also about the rise of high pressing in global football and our susceptibility to it, because we want to play through our centre-backs. And if your centre-back loses the ball to an opposition player, they're through on goal straight away. So I think it makes a lot of sense for that reason, and that is why we're seeing it now.
Do you feel as though we're playing a higher tempo in Europe as well? I thought last year we were slow, we were tepid. It looked like we were trying to conserve energy, and I feel this year we've gone out. I mean, you know, you're right, we're counter-attacking, but we're counter-attacking at pace, and I felt like we never reached top gear in any of the matches last year.
I think there's a genuine focus on the Champions League this year. We're not going away. Like last year we went away to Monaco and we rested players, and we're not resting players now. Kane possibly might have been able to play against Manchester United, but it was ruled out. No, he's been saved for Madrid, and I just think there's more of a focus on it now to try and get out of this group.
Have you seen much of Spurs in Europe this season, Duncan?
I watched the Real Madrid game and the Dortmund game, and I think just generally the Premier League's looking particularly good, and we've obviously got five teams for the first time, and there does seem to be a real kind of step up from the league as a whole. I think you could argue that both Barcelona and Real Madrid are, you know, not at their best at the moment. Same with the German teams as well. So I think, you know, it's looking, and it is very cyclical. You know, you go back to the 2000s when the Premier League last kind of dominated the competition. It was with two managers, you know, Mourinho and Benitez, who came in and really kind of set a style that then other teams in the Premier League kind of followed, and it was a template that worked for a few years. And I think we're kind of at that, a different template now, but a similar sort of situation.
Interesting. And would Pochettino be one of the managers that other teams would be trying to emulate, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I think obviously him, Guardiola and Klopp as well, you know, they've all in different ways had a lot of success in Europe. Well, Pochettino less so, but, you know, I think he's kind of making a mark, and, you know, this season really is, it does feel different.
Second question this time round is from Lane to Glory on Reddit, who says, what kind of role do you think momentum plays in football? It's obviously a separate discussion from tactics, but it would be great to hear your views. For instance, would a win against West Ham have improved our chances against United in terms of the mentality of the players, even though many of the players for the West Ham game didn't start against United? Any thoughts?
As a tactics guy and also kind of a statistics guy, we tend to sort of play down the intangibles. But if you've played football, and I recommend you do it, it's a lot of fun. You can feel firsthand what momentum feels like. You know when you're on a run of good games and things just sort of come off of you, and you know when you've had a run of bad games and suddenly you can't make a 5-yard pass. So yeah, of course momentum is a huge thing.
I'm so weak mentally that when I'm playing five-a-side, if I make one bad pass, that affects my whole game. That's genuinely, if I make a good pass in the first 5 minutes, I know I'm going to have a good game. Or if I score a goal or something good happens, I'm going to have a good game. I'm that weak-willed. Got no drive about me at all. Bardi, I'm guessing you're a fan of Momentum.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Momentum. Plus,
proper football man.
Not just for proper football man. It's not just for the players, it's for the supporters
yeah,
as well.
Totally.
Because if you beat West Ham, you can almost kind of accept losing away at Old Trafford because it's one of those things. You lose at Old Trafford, Tottenham lose at Old Trafford, a lot of teams do. But if you beat West Ham, you kind of like can take it a little bit better. Instead, now we've lost two games in a row, and now we've got Real Madrid, and then all of a sudden you're looking at three, and then you got a game, then it's the international break, and all of a sudden the mood, how it was, changes completely. Momentum is massive.
Yes.
And there's a reason why someone like Mourinho will only use a certain number of players per season, because it keeps the momentum, keeps everybody flowing in the same way.
And you could see it with some of our key players during the purple patch we've just had. I mean, Kane was basically unplayable at points in that spell he's just had. And hopefully he'll come back and be unplayable again. But that's clearly momentum. He's built up to that point. He hasn't just started being that good immediately at the start of the season. He's built slowly to that point. So that there has to be something to say about that.
I think we're in a kind of strange meta world now where I did wonder in August, because obviously we pushed out the stat that Kane has never scored in August in the Premier League, which we did last year, which, you know, a few people took notes, but became a big thing this year. You know, it was on the back of papers and stuff. And you do wonder where, you know, there was a point when Kane was through on goal in one of your home games, and you do wonder whether it's playing on his mind. Suddenly he knows he's never scored in the Premier League in August. And it's kind of a world where, you know, as you say, you know, a few bad results go into an international break, suddenly the whole atmosphere around the club is down, and that will affect players. And it is, it's kind of the two, you know, the supporters' world and the players' world are kind of merging a bit, I think.
Is anyone else feeling an apology coming on here? I feel like Duncan should be writing an apology to Harry Kane for August.
Well, if he, you know, he did write in September.
Yeah,
right.
But you feel like it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, he's had one bad August, so, and he might then read about that, and it gets into his head somehow, and it becomes a psychological barrier in a way.
Yeah, I mean, players aren't immune. That, you know, they'll read stuff and they'll learn, and you can see it with other things. Well, you know, like the Merseyside derby has got a lot of red cards, and obviously it's a local derby, and it will have some anyway. But you can kind of see players being like, well, this is a, you know, I'm going to fly into a tackle because of this, blah, blah, blah. And going back to momentum, the absolute perfect example of that was Vardy's run of 11.
Yeah,
because I mean, you know, going back to XG, the XG for some of those goals he scored towards the end of that run was pretty low, you know, particularly the one to break the record. He basically just, you know, hit it against United, you know, beat De Gea at near post, I think. And, you know, he probably wouldn't have taken that shot if he wasn't in such an amazing run. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of hot hand theory as well, isn't it? So.
I don't believe that Wembley is cursed, but I do believe that it's played on the players' minds, and that's why it's so good that we've now got a couple of results at Wembley to sort of wipe that sort of curse hanging over everyone's head. So that's an example of momentum in work.
Football players are babies. They will use any excuse to not perform. The year Ferguson said he was going to retire at the end of the year, you saw what happened to that Man United team. They stopped playing. When there's a board takeover, when there's issues, the football player will use any excuse to just underperform.
Redknapp in England.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Chelsea the season, Mourinho after they won the title and Mourinho got the sack. I mean, yeah, you know, players can affect stuff in such a massive way, and just, yeah, it's strange.
So you've got to stop. It's got momentum is really important. You don't let players think. Do like in the Inter in the 60s, they're not allowed to see their family, they're not allowed to do anything, lock them up.
Poch he's been pretty good in the past at turning things around quickly, I think. Where we've had a mini blip, he's good at kind of getting the players back on side and making sure the results then turn themselves around naturally.
Yes, but I don't think we've ever had a set of games like this before.
True, we've got a horrible run.
Yeah.
Normally, and the international break is never a good thing when you're losing.
You don't want to have lost two in a row then face Real Madrid.
No, kind of absolutely. We spoke briefly about the Old Trafford performance, but Nath07White on Twitter says, is our record away at the top six a sign of the times, or do we lack the bite or punch in the big away days to get a result on the road? And he's sort of presented the image that Sky have shown numerous times of Pochettino's away record against the top six, and it's not good reading. I mean, he had in 2015-16 we managed 6 points in those games, but only one win. 14-15 1 point, 16-17 2, and obviously this year we've only played the one match and have 0 points so far. But what do you think?
Away to the top six is sort of by definition the hardest games we play. And I think that it's fine to set the expectation as an assumed loss. How many is it? Six draws in that time? Each one of those draws is a worthy achievement. Mm-hmm. And if we, this is kind of a statistical thing, but if you look back at the correlation between the team who has the best record against the top six or the top four or whatever, and the team who wins the league, there's not a huge correlation there. There are 114 points available in the league, and there's 18 away to the top six. It doesn't matter. It's not. It matters for momentum, as we just touched on. But in terms of winning the league, which I think is what we're looking towards, it's just not that big a deal.
Do you think it matters in terms of a statement, which is the word that Sky always use when they describe these matches?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. As again, momentum we looked at, and you're also robbing your opposition of points. But outside of that, I just think it's fine.
There's one chapter in Duncan's book, I can't remember what year it is, but Man United lost away to Chelsea, Arsenal, other big six, and they still won the league at a canter. It kind of matters a little bit. It's making a statement, if you want to put it that way, but as Nathan said, those group of points are so small compared to the rest of the points on offer that doesn't really make a huge difference.
I think it matters when it comes to kind of leaving a legacy. So if you think of, you know, like when United won 5-3 at White Hart Lane, you know, if you're just going for your first title in a long, long time, you don't care. Like you say, just get the points wherever you can, win the league. But then if you're trying to kind of build a legacy, then you kind of probably do need to leave some sort of famous performances away at your rivals. But yeah, as you say, it's not that important.
We don't not have those. We have the 5-3 against Chelsea. We have the 2-0 against Chelsea. We've had a good bunch of results against Arsenal recently. So there's and the 4-1 against Liverpool. So there's not a complete absence of those big game results. We just don't have an amazingly shining record.
Our final question in this episode is from Jack Kirby on Twitter. And we've got so much potential here to make us sound incredibly pretentious and smug. Jack says, what tips would you give someone looking to increase their ability to read the game and develop tactical understanding, rather than, ooh, he's run up and down a lot, oh, now he's done a goal, which is sometimes a level I feel my understanding is at? I like the way Jack worded that question. Nathan, any thoughts?
Sometimes I feel that my understanding is that level, because you get drawn into the excitement of the game and all you're doing is ooh and ahhing. I haven't consciously thought about how I think about tactics. I got into football a little late, actually, and I'm a bit of a nerd, so I was sort of naturally drawn to that side of things. I guess I would say read up on a particular tactical concept and just bear that in mind with the next game. So Spurs like to force the opposition to play the ball long rather than let the opposition pass it about the back. So just with the next Spurs game, look at how they do that, which sort of sounds like homework. And if it feels like homework, don't do it, because it's boring and it's encroaching on your experience of the game.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And again, I really don't see myself as having a particularly high-level tactical understanding, more just a tactical interest. But I would say focus on a particular player you enjoy watching. That's how I kind of got into that side of it. So one of the first players that that made me think this way was Michael Carrick. I loved watching Carrick play. Loads of fans didn't enjoy Carrick because they couldn't see what he was doing. So that made me want to prove even more what he was doing was having an impact. So I looked at Carrick's position in the grander scheme of the team and kind of worked out the good he was doing, and ended up writing thousands of words on forums that probably 15 people read about how amazing Carrick was for Spurs. And I was right, obviously, so there's that. But that's, yeah, basically how I recommend starting. Bardi, any tips?
Well, for me personally, if you go to a stadium, sit as high as you can. It's great to sit behind a goal or low down. It's a bit more atmosphere, but you can't really see the game. If you go to watch a live football match, there's nothing quite like having a high vantage point to be able to see how the team moves. That's what I would recommend anyway, to get your grips that way.
Anything from you, Duncan? Are you into tactics? Do you find tactics interesting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I come from it from a statistical point of view. So, I mean, I like looking at the data and then kind of retro-applying that to players. And so, for instance, Harry Kane consistently outperformed his XG for 3 years in a row. Probably isn't a one-season wonder, we can confirm. But if you actually look, he's not a player that scores stunning goals. I mean, he does a few, but he's just very kind of consistent. And once you kind of know that he is outperforming the average, if you actually then watch his shots and his positioning in the penalty box, you can kind of see he's doing stuff that to the naked eye probably wouldn't, you know, it doesn't leap off the page, but he really is kind of impressive. And it's also something that's quite sustainable, I think. You know, mm-hmm. it's not like he's a player that relies on raw pace that could just go overnight like someone did, Michael Owen did, for instance. So, it's like looking at little trends like that, I think it's pretty good.
Nice, yeah. I mean, Kane's just super efficient. I think that's what it comes down to. He knows his strengths and he does his strengths so well. And, you know, obviously he's got many strengths, but that particular strength of just finding the bottom corner time and time and time again will stand him in good stead for many, many years to come, hopefully. As ever, we kind of have a section called Further Reading where we all kind of recommend an article or a book or a podcast, something that we've read or listened to recently. Should I start with Nathan this week?
Yeah, if you have listened to this podcast and are intrigued about statistics, then I recommend checking out chanceanalytics.com. It's a sort of a statistical blog. It was down for a little while, but the site's back up now, and there's a backlog of good stuff to read there.
I watched a really nice documentary on YouTube by 442. It was about goalkeepers, position I've always felt I played in goal for most of my life, so I do feel a bit of love towards them. And it was a really nice documentary. It had a bit Arsenal heavy, Graham Stack and Jens Lehmann were on it, but there were other goalkeepers as well talking about how kind of rare it is in modern football and the kind of different way they have to approach the game and look at the game. It's 20 minutes long, so it's a nice easy watch on YouTube.
Nice. Duncan?
Reading a book called Beatable at the moment. It's about the Golden State Warriors in basketball, obviously, and how they basically went from being absolutely terrible to, you know, world beaters. And it's very good from a sort of data point of view in the sense that it wasn't all down to data, but it shows how a kind of unified philosophy at a club, any sports club, can kind of make a big difference. And you see that now with certain clubs in the Premier League, of which I'd include Spurs. You know, there's a very joined up kind of thinking across the whole organisation, which, you know, is a kind of virtuous circle.
See, he's saying nice things now to win favour among Spurs fans, isn't he? And rightly so. And I would like to recommend the Academy Productivity Rankings 2016-17, which is an incredibly snappy title, written by a guy who was trying to decide which academy to put his son into, and published by Training Ground Guru. So it's on the Training Ground Guru website, which is trainingground.guru. It's a fascinating ranking of the 86 Category 1 to 3 clubs.
Wow.
This is peak win.
No, this is genuinely
a
brilliant read.
What was that title again? Because I missed it.
Academy Productivity Rankings 2016-17.
Is it in PDF format? Yeah.
I imagine it is. No, there definitely is. It's basically written as a journal article in an academic
It's not going to bang with that title. He needs to rework
You've
that
You've got to
title.
Search for it in Google Scholar.
It is absolutely fascinating. And Spurs come out of this incredibly well. So it's interesting from that perspective. But, I mean, just the fact that Crewe Alexandra are ninth amongst Category 1 to 3 clubs in terms of their productivity above many of the Category 1 clubs, which I think is just an incredible achievement. You know, maybe they need to change their priorities a little bit and worry more about staying in the Football League. But still, I mean, who can't admire that? And Charlton, who were in the third tier, but came seventh in the table, is another huge success story. They produced 44 professionals across the top five divisions, which I think is quite a staggering achievement.
How long does this go back, though?
This is just for this year, really? But okay. So we're looking at players that are in the league at the time of writing.
Okay.
But I imagine that it's been such a success that I imagine he'll do it year on year and keep the data going. But it's really interesting, and I just like the fact that he was trying to find the best place to send his son as well. And it kind of, in many ways, ties into the kind of general narrative at the moment about youth football and England's success in the Under-17 World Cup and how the changes have been made at grassroots level across the last 10-15 years and the impact, the fruit that is starting to bear. There's a lot to be hopeful about, really. Right, I mean, before we go, I just want to say a massive thank you to Cave at SNK Studios, who's housed us again. Cave's brilliant guy. I recommend following him on Twitter. He's got excellent opinions on Spurs and the studio is phenomenal. If ever you need any recording space, then consider Cave and get in touch with him. Where can people find more of your content online, Duncan?
Well, there's mainly on Twitter, but be that OptiJoe or my own one.
You run part of the OptiJoe. You run the OptiJoe account with others, do you?
Yeah. I mean, me and a couple of colleagues started it in 2009 on a whim, and it's done all right. We passed 1 million followers last month.
So amazing! Such a success.
That's quite good. But yeah, I mean, you know, we're everywhere as well. You know, we're working with all the broadcasters, all the newspapers. So. People want to send in requests as well. You know, we're always open to good ideas, so feel free.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure to have you here and have your insight. Bardi, good to see you back.
Cheers, Windy.
Always nice to see your smiling face. and you are at BardiTFC on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Nathan, rebranded.
Nathan A. Clark.
I have enjoyed Nathan's. Now he's got his face out there. He's getting and he's trying controversial. Yeah.
Someone referred to you as Jesus.
I did get called Jesus the other day. Yeah. I mean, I'm a Larry person, and that's coming through now. So yeah.
Stick at it. Well, thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it. Feel free to give us some feedback, good or bad, and ideas for talking points in the future. Obviously, this has been stats heavy, so we've done tactics, we've done stats. Give us some ideas of what you'd like to hear next, and we'll be back in 4 to 6 weeks. Thank you very much for listening.
It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock. It's the Fight In. It's the Fight In. Clock.
Oh, that was really interesting, mate, yeah.
Welcome to Bose Recommends. This is the place to discover your new favourite podcast. Every week, we listen to hundreds of shows to bring you our favourites. And this is one we think you're going to love.
Hello, I'm Rob Deering. This is Paul Tonkinson.
Good morning.
We are Running Commentary, or we create Running Commentary. It's our podcast.
We are, and we're very excited to be part of Bose Recommends.
We certainly are. Thank you, Bose. And listen to Running Commentary. As you can hear, hopefully hear, we record it while we're running.
That's it. We're talking about running whilst running. For runners, but people listen to it when they're not running.
That's right, and we often talk about other things. I mean, it's not
just... We talk about everything.
It's life.
It's life stuff.
Yeah.
Bit of running advice, bit of life stuff. A few laughs,
bit of slapstick,
bit of fun. Stop it, a bit of a story, why not?
Yeah.
So drinking.
It's the City of Running and Drinking podcast.
We've done 100 episodes and counting, haven't we?
Comes out every week, every Thursday. So listen to Running Commentary on your favourite podcast app, Acast, iTunes. Go for it.
That was this week's Bose Recommends, the place to discover your new favourite show. If you want to find out how you can enjoy podcasts and even better sound quality, visit bose.co.uk. Bose. Get closer.